This is your September 1st, 2020 podcast. I'm Stacey Clardy, section editor of the Neurology Podcast and Neurology Minute. This week's What's Trending feature brings the third installment of our five-part series on everything you need to know to manage ischemic stroke. In the second segment, you'll hear a discussion on brain-responsive neurostimulation for focal epilepsy.
Welcome back to the What's Trending segment. This is Dan Ackerman from St. Luke's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And once again, I'd like to welcome Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. Andy, thank you so much for coming back.
Thanks for having me back, Dan.
So Andy, today let's talk about big clots and the interventions we love. So many moons ago, the pathway towards thrombectomy began just as a distant vision with systems like Mercy and Penumbra. And then in 2014 and 2015, the world turned on its ear just a little bit with some really excellent trial data, and mostly using some newer systems, including Trevo and Solitaire, and a lot of interesting and different strategies for patient selection and timing. So Andy, let's start with this. Currently, what is the time frame for someone who may be a candidate for thrombectomy if they're found to have a large vessel occlusion?
Well, Dan, as you mentioned, our first generation of trials for thrombectomy that were positive and came out back in 2014-2015 timeframe suggested that there was absolute benefit for patients meeting certain eligibility criteria, such as severe stroke with an NIH short scale greater than or equal to 6, and then obviously presence of a large vessel occlusion and some others, that if they met those eligibility criteria, that they would benefit up to 6 hours from last known well. And that was sort of our first generation of level 1A evidence supporting the use of thrombectomy. Subsequently, we've had two really pivotal trials in the DAWN trial and DIFFUSE 3 trial that suggested additional benefit. In DIFFUSE 3's case, up to 16 hours from last known well. In the DAWN trial, up to 24 hours from last known well in patients that additionally have perfusion imaging to suggest there's a mismatch between the amount of brain tissue that is infarcted or at risk of dying and the tissue that's actually already dead. And that's, of course, is our surrogate for the penumbra. And as I've heard you say many times, be calm, save the penumbra. And in this case, our treatment window goes out to 24 hours. And frankly, I'll editorialize here that those are still arbitrary time windows. There are many people out there who believe that we should do away with all the time windows and just look at every individual stroke presentation based on the tissue imaging. And in that case, there may be very late progressors of people that complete their infarct even past 24 hours for whom there still may be some benefit. But time will tell whether our data follows that up in a supportive way.
Absolutely. This really gets into some of what we talked about in our first week about the idea of using imaging to a degree as a surrogate for time and really establishing brain viability. And on average, we talk about losing 2 million neurons a minute during a stroke, but ultimately that's an average. Some people are faster, some people are slower. Now, Andy, there are a lot of different strategies that are used for patient selection. So aspect score, which is one that you mentioned a couple of weeks ago. There's also what we call clinical core mismatch, and then the calculation of penumbra versus core ratio. So what do you prefer, and how do you apply these different criteria in different situations?
Dan, because my practice started out really focused on those patients in the 0 to 6 hour window, I do find the aspect score helpful for those patients who are early in the thrombectomy window. And for those out there, you can look this up online, but essentially it's looking at a non-contrast head CT to look for the amount of different regions of an ischemic territory that are already showing early signs of ischemia. And if they meet a certain score, then it suggests that they still have brain tissue that could be salvaged. If they already have a lot of regions of their brain that are looking like they could be infarcted, then they're less likely to benefit. One of my colleagues, Joe Carrera up at Michigan, is doing some interesting research looking at a CTA aspect score as well that may even have some better accuracy for that patient population. Of course, if you're a believer in our perfusion-based imaging, CT perfusion or MRI-based perfusion data, then this really is probably the easiest, some may say color by numbers approach to assessing patients who may benefit. And it truly is that. If you've seen some of this software, it actually shows you a color-coded map between brain tissue that is already infarcted or dead, often indicated by cerebral blood flow, versus tissue that's at risk of dying, indicated by the amount of time it takes for perfusion through the territory. And if there's a mismatch there, then they're going to benefit. So what do I prefer? I still use aspect score early in the thrombectomy window. Late in the thrombectomy window, sort of 6 to 24 hours, I rely on the perfusion-based imaging.
I really appreciate that you called it that color by number approach. I really love those maps. I definitely find them easy to use. And I think there's some great data on the surface. And then when you look at some of the generating and source images, there's really a lot more that you can glean that's really helpful. Where I initially trained, we were doing perfusion maps manually with some amazing CT technologists. But of course, a lot of these more recent trials are using commercial software that automates the process. What have you seen as far as that goes?
Well, I think there's obviously a lot of great technology that's going into this multimodal imaging that we're getting nowadays, and even the introduction of a lot of machine learning and automated type support that goes into algorithms that really, for better or for worse, sort of take some of the thinking out of it. I think that is good on the one hand for, say, 90% of the patients who are going to be eligible for that kind of imaging. But sort of like the way that we use MRI to diagnose a stroke or that we've used it over the years, I still tell my residents and my fellows to make sure that their clinical judgment, clinical decision-making stays at the top of the ladder for their guiding decision-making in these situations. Because I think if we get so reliant on the imaging, then we're going to overlook things and potentially bias ourselves to making poor decisions in some instances.
Absolutely. Treat the patient, not the picture, right?
That's right.
So, Andy, I work with a comprehensive stroke center and several primary stroke centers, and a lot of my primary stroke centers have asked about whether or not they should have perfusion imaging available so that they can image a patient prior to transfer. I've seen some different ideas as far as this goes. What do you think about perfusion imaging prior to transfer to a thrombectomy-capable or comprehensive stroke center?
Well, Dan, that's a really important question, and it highlights a bigger conversation that we're having in the stroke community about our stroke systems of care that have been introduced in the thrombectomy era and sort of how best to be efficient when we're transferring patients from, say, a first hospital to a comprehensive stroke center and the vascular capable center, as you mentioned. I think this is going to be very dependent on the capabilities of either the acute stroke ready hospital or primary stroke center they get to first. And so, for instance, we've got several relationships at my institution, which is a comprehensive stroke center with spoke hospitals in rural parts of Virginia. And some of these hospitals are able to do that advanced perfusion-based imaging and get it done in a relatively timely way. Of course, there's a cost to doing that to the hospital and so forth, but it does allow them to keep a few additional patients at their hospital that might otherwise have been transferred. On the other hand, there are a number of smaller hospitals that either that perfusion-based imaging is cost prohibitive for them or we're unable to get it done in a timely or an efficient way, particularly after hours when there's less staff and so forth, and it ends up delaying the patient's care. And in those situations, we tend to want to transfer the patient to the comprehensive stroke center and get that additional imaging there. So I think I don't have a perfect answer that's going to fit every situation. It really is very dependent on the regional geography, the capabilities of each of the hospitals, and the relationship.
Absolutely. So just to recap, it may be reasonable to consider CT perfusion at a primary stroke center or an initial evaluating hospital in some situations, but we want to be very careful to avoid creating delays by requiring that imaging, especially at centers that are not necessarily accustomed to doing it. One possible advantage may be keeping certain patients in their local community if their imaging prior to transfer would not be favorable for an intervention.
I think that's well said, Dan. And I should also put a plug in here for telestroke, which many of us practice and has become really standard of care as another way to improve the efficiency of the evaluation at, say, a spoke hospital and to improve the efficiency of our transfers for thrombectomy.
See, you heard it here first. You too can have Dr. Andy Sutherland, who's available by telestroke throughout the United States.
That's right, as long as they allow my state medical license to travel.
There you go. Sticking with that theme of transfer for one more moment, how does transfer time play into the arrival scenario when you bring a patient into your hospital? Is there a certain threshold after which you would want to re-image the patient rather than taking them straight to cath lab, either with a repeat non-contrast head CT or with perfusion imaging, even if they've already had it?
Yeah, that's another good question, Dan. And we borrow our practice from the original ESCAPE trial, which was one of the first generation thrombectomy trials in which patients who were transferred, if there had been greater than 1 hour from their original imaging or their last highest level of imaging, then we will repeat that imaging. And it's important in that case because there could have been a transition from tissue that looked like it could be salvageable or penumbra to fully infarcted tissue. And you wouldn't want to then subject a patient to treatment who may be at higher risk or may not benefit. Of course, that's going to be very case by case. you know, 1 hour, like all of our time windows in stroke, is somewhat arbitrary and not very person specific. And things like age, severity of stroke, et cetera, may all play into that decision making.
So there has been some recent discussion and even some controversy about the role of Alta Place in folks who have large vessel occlusion. In a lot of the original trials, I remember that there were sort of almost four arms, those who got Alta Place versus those who got Alta Place plus thrombectomy, and then those who did not qualify for Alta Place versus those who did not qualify for Alta Place and also got thrombectomy. What are you guys doing about this at this point? And do you anticipate it changing, or should we still be giving TPA to all of these folks whenever possible?
Well, you know, I'm a company man when it comes to this sort of question, and the data all continues to point to TPA as being first-line treatment for people that are eligible with acute ischemic stroke, and there's been no reliable prospective clinical trial data to suggest that there is no benefit of TPA, even in patients with large clots or large vessel occlusion. So bottom line, if a patient's eligible for IV TPA, they should be offered treatment, even if you're also moving quickly to get that patient to thrombectomy if they have evidence of large vessel occlusion and salvageable brain tissue or penumbra. Of course, there's still a lot of interest in this. There's very energetic conversations that happen at stroke meetings in tightly packed rooms about whether patients should be transferred directly to comprehensive stroke centers or into vascular centers and risk of delaying initial TPA, et cetera. And we're still trying to sort all that out. But again, it really underscores the importance of thinking about situations more in our systems of stroke care rather than on an individual basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. With the exception of the large packed rooms. These days, it's a large packed Zoom meeting.
This is very true in our current environment.
Now, after someone has had a thrombectomy, does that change the way that you monitor them after their stroke treatment, regardless of whether they've gotten TPA or not?
So we monitor all of our thrombectomy patients somewhat similar to our TPA patients in the sense they get monitored at least 24 hours in a neurological ICU. With thrombectomy, you have to also be worried about injury or reperfusion hemorrhage from reestablishing blood flow into freshly infarcted tissue. The management of blood pressure after a thrombectomy has been somewhat of a moving target. We've got a number of publications and guideline content around the blood pressure goals after thrombectomy. At my center, we follow a blood pressure goal of less than 180 over 105, similar to thrombolysis, but that may vary from center to center. And then, of course, just like any catheterization procedure, you're going to monitor the arterial puncture site, et cetera. But otherwise, hopefully, most of these patients do well.
We have a pretty similar paradigm, although at our shop, we're a little bit more stringent with the blood pressure. We like to keep it less than 160 for those patients that have had a large vessel occlusion removal. But 180 is a completely reasonable goal as well. And there's certainly a lot of good data to look at and no single hard and fast answer there.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And certainly a tighter blood pressure is going to give you additional protection against that sort of very worrisome potential of reperfusion hemorrhage.
I've also seen some differences from interventionalist to interventionalist with regard to imaging right after a thrombectomy procedure. There is some concern for contrast staining on the imaging that could mimic a bleeding complication but not actually represent bleeding. What do you guys do in terms of imaging, and is it any different than what you would do for any stroke patient?
Unless the patient has a clinical change or neurological worsening or something that would indicate to us that they may have had a reperfusion hemorrhage or a symptomatic hemorrhage after thrombectomy, we typically follow a similar imaging protocol as we would with our other patients, which will include ultimately getting an MRI at some point to see the size of the infarct. But other than that, we don't have a strict guideline for getting imaging sooner than that.
Andy, in the post-COVID era of stroke treatment, there's a lot of discussion about limiting aerosolizing procedures. When you guys are in the interventional suite, do you tend to favor intubation or monitored anesthesia care? What's your current practice, and has that changed now with COVID around?
Well, the answer to the second part of your question is yes, that interventionalists who traditionally favored more conscious sedation and wanted to get to the thrombectomy procedure without any delays requiring intubation, almost everyone now, particularly in patients who are under investigation for COVID, are preferring aerosolized intubation prior to thrombectomy. And that is just reflective of the current environment that we are in. There's a lot of good literature about the subject of acute stroke care and the setting of the COVID-19 pandemic that has come out in the Stroke Journal and others related to triage and protected stroke codes and the additional benefit of telemedicine and other things that I highly encourage all the listeners to seek out given our current events. As far as the prior question of preference over one versus the other, there have been a number of clinical trials looking at this, and I think that there still is a lot of individual preference between practitioners and how they manage this or deal with this as far as conscious sedation versus intubation, and I'm not sure that we have an exact right answer.
Well, Andy, thank you so much for talking with us again. And we'd encourage everyone to stay tuned for next week's What's Trending segment on stroke with the Neurology Podcast.
Hello, this is Hallie Alexander from Wake Forest University. Today I'm speaking with Martha Morrell, Professor of Neurology at Stanford University and Chief Medical Officer of NeuroPace. We're discussing the recent article in Neurology titled 9-Year Prospective Efficacy and Safety of Brain-Responsive Neurostimulation for Focal Epilepsy. Marty, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Hallie. I'm excited to be able to share this.
So this paper reports on the findings from the open-label long-term follow-up trial of responsive neurostimulation, or what we call RNS. And we do have a wide range of listeners, so do you mind first just explaining briefly what RNS is and how it works?
So first, the RNS system is FDA approved in the U.S. for adjunctive treatment of medically intractable partial onset seizures coming from one or two regions in adults, one or two foci. And the technology really, if you think about cardiac defibrillators, that's a good way to think about it. So for seizures, most people with epilepsy, even very severe epilepsy, spend most of the time not having seizures. And seizures generally involve a part, but not all of the brain. So the thought is, what if you treat a patient only when they need it? And what if you treat only where it is needed? So the way this was developed is to create a device that has electrodes that are placed according to the seizure focus. There are actually two leads with 8 electrodes. And those electrodes are sensing all of the time and providing that information to a neurostimulator. And when patterns that the physician has said these are abnormal are detected by the neurostimulator, brief pulses of stimulation are provided in response. So these pulses are generally 100 to 200 milliseconds, only when there's a divergence from normal. So in total, we're talking about a few minutes of stimulation a day. And the stimulation is not felt by the patient. So the other part of this, which also kind of comes from cardiac devices, is that all of this data is stored by the neurostimulator and sent over the internet to the secure database. And any physician with a password, so if you have a patient, you have a password that lets you look at your patient's data, it's all there, it's all accumulated. So you can look at whenever a detection's been made, whenever a stimulation is delivered, and even look at snapshots of the raw intracranial EEG. And this has turned out to be very important in the overall treatment. You learn a lot about your patient, and you're also able to fine-tune the detection and the stimulation based on this information that you're getting.
Great. Thank you so much for explaining all that for us. So now we'll go on to the paper. How does this 9-year follow-up data change clinical practice regarding RNS? So in other words, what do we know now that we didn't know, for example, at the end of the 2-year randomized controlled trial?
Right. So the randomized controlled trial was the, rigorous class 1 double-blind placebo-controlled trial that showed a differentiation between those who were receiving active and those who were receiving sham stimulation. That was, an evaluation over 5 months, and then these patients were followed for 2 years, so that's great. But people have epilepsy over their lifetime, and so you really need to know whether a treatment is going to last for years. Of course, we always start with anti-epileptic drugs. They will always be the mainstay of treatment. But for some people with epilepsy, I think we've all had this experience, the medications will work well for a period of time, but then the effect wears off. And as epilepsy changes over years, medications that worked at one time may not work at other times. So we really wanted to know whether this was a long-term solution for people with partial onset seizures. And what was found was that not only does the efficacy last, but it gets better over time. So in the 2-year data, the responder rate or the median percent reduction was in the 60s. By 9 years, the responder rate or percentage of patients who had a 50% or greater reduction was 73%. And there's a range of responses like there is with any treatment. But over a third of patients had a 90% or greater reduction in their seizures. And although the intent of a patient should not be to expect they would be seizure-free, however, over 18% did have at least a year of seizure freedom, and the average period of seizure freedom was more than 3 years. So the other piece, you know, that we're looking for is not just reduction in seizures, but as life improved. And with any effective epilepsy treatment, you have to see an improvement in quality of life, and that was certainly seen here. But in addition, there were improvements in cognition and also in mood, which are areas of quality of life that are not necessarily improved by other treatments. And then finally, you get a lot of safety data when you follow somebody over 9 years. And with a device, of course, you worry about infection. So the infection rate, we can say, held steady at about 4% when the neurostimulator was replaced. And these are incision site infections, almost always, or soft tissue infections. There is, of course, the risk associated with placing the leads, but this is done by neurosurgeons who know what they're doing. And so that risk is less than 3 out of 100, and they were all largely asymptomatic. We also wanted to know, because there really hasn't been an experience with this, whether there are any risks to receiving stimulation over this period of time. And that was not the case.
I'm glad you brought that up about counseling the patients about the type of benefit that they might be able to receive from RNS, because it is a good point that when we're talking to our patients, we need to remember that this isn't necessarily a treatment that will result in seizure freedom, although it may, as you pointed out, but it's not necessarily the expected result. The expectation is a reduction in seizures. In contrast to a lot of our other available therapies, you were able to show that RNS can have the ability to improve quality of life, cognition, and mood. And then you also talked to us about a lot of the safety data that you obtained, which is helpful in counseling our patients. But one question that might be on our providers' minds and our patients' minds is, how about the risk of SUDEP? Is there any increased risk of SUDEP using RNS?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought this up. You know, of course, this is the horrific risk for uncontrolled epilepsy. And we estimate that the risk for SUDEP in patients with very severe epilepsy who are waiting for epilepsy surgery is as high as 9 per 1,000 patient years, or almost 1 in 100 deaths for every year. For people with medically intractable epilepsy who have participated in anti-epileptic drug trials in the placebo arm, that risk is almost 7 per 1,000. And in the long-term treatment study, the risk was 2.8 per 1,000. Subsequent to this data set, Oren Davinsky at NYU and Daniel Friedman at the same institution have published a paper aggregating a larger experience, and it places the risk at 2.0. So I think that it is important to recognize that epilepsy is a disease that carries a higher risk for mortality, and that offering a treatment that reduces seizure frequency may improve life expectancy, not just quality of life.
Excellent. So then what type of patients do you refer for RNS in your everyday practice? Or in other words, what might an ideal candidate look like? I'm assuming now that we have this 9-year data, we know a little bit more about which patients might be more or less appropriate for RNS therapy.
We certainly do. We know about those patients who met the inclusion and exclusion criteria for the study. But what's exciting is a lot of physicians are actively publishing on their experience in other groups of patients. So we're learning that patients who may benefit are quite diverse. It does begin with patients in whom you can identify the seizure onset zone, and it can be large seizure onset zones. Brandy Mon, Vikram Rao recently published that they were able to effectively treat patients whose zones were as large as 11 centimeters, so almost a lobe. In this study, in the long-term treatment study, one of the pre-specified endpoints was to look at what predicted benefit. And what was found is that the outcomes were as good in people whose seizures began in mesial temporal structures as those whose seizures began in the neocortex. And also, the observation was that it was effective in all lobes. Another pre-specified assessment was whether having tried a VNS before or having tried an epilepsy surgery would predict whether you were more or less likely to benefit, and it did not. As far as specific patient groups are concerned, it didn't matter whether there was a lesion on the MRI scan or not. And there have been other publications, as I mentioned, in people with autoimmune epilepsy, periventricular nodular heterotopias, tuberous sclerosis. And we're really looking forward to, for such an emerging therapy, for those who are treating patients to share their experience. All of those experiences are very important.
Great. So like you mentioned earlier, then an ideal candidate obviously would have focal epilepsy. It's not FDA approved for those with generalized epilepsy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There is not data on whether this treatment approach would be helpful for people whose seizures are generalized in onset. So that at this time is not a patient that would fall within our experience or patients that we would think are good patients. So really, if you have knowledge of the region in which the seizures start, the focus, whether that's small or big, then that's somebody you should think about as a possible candidate for the RNS system.
Okay, great. And like you said, it doesn't matter which lobe, they can be considered for RNS even if they've failed surgery in the past or have failed a different type of neurostimulation like the VNS.
That's absolutely correct. Yes.
And you mentioned autoimmune epilepsy. So I'm curious about that because we don't always think of that as being a focal epilepsy. So in the studies where they've used it in autoimmune patients, is that specifically for a limbic focus or have all types of autoimmune epilepsy shown to benefit from RNS?
Well, the experience on this is very small. Dr. Shin at University of North Carolina and Dr. Fayessa at Mayo Clinic, Jacksonville, Florida, have published on a small number of patients they have treated with autoimmune epilepsy. I think one concern has been whether there is a higher risk for infection in people who may be taking immunosuppressants. So it was reassuring to see that the safety was good. And that also the outcomes were very similar to the outcomes reported in other patient populations.
Well, that's exciting because that's definitely a population where we can sometimes struggle with seizure control. Now, on the practical side with the device, how expensive is it to the healthcare system, to the patient? What information do we have on the cost effectiveness of this device?
Well, the first thing is whether this is covered by insurers. And fortunately, 98% of patients who have wanted to have access to RNS system, whose physicians have recommended it, have been able to get it. And that is private insurers, it's Medicare, it's even the Medicaid plans. So I believe the insurers recognize that epilepsy is an expensive disorder, intractable epilepsy. Medications are not inexpensive. All those visits to emergency rooms are very expensive. It takes a lot of years to do formal costs of the health economics, and the RNS system has not been around long enough to do those kinds of studies, but one of those studies was done for the vagus nerve stimulator. The late Sandy Helmer at Emory conducted an excellent study, and it showed that this other device therapy was highly cost-effective. So as we discussed, if you can reduce the frequency of seizures, you can reduce healthcare costs and you can reduce suffering. And we really believe that neuromodulation therapies in general and the RNS system specifically are able to do that.
So what is next then for RNS? I know, like you mentioned earlier, some research is already being done using the data that we are able to gather and store from this device to look at things such as better understanding seizure patterns, using it for seizure forecasting. What other future advances do you think are likely to come out of RNS, either in the research world or for the system itself?
So this has been one of the astonishing parts of this journey. When the first patient was treated in 2004, the thought was that this was a device that was a therapeutic device. You know, the intent was to make seizures better. But what has been discovered over time is it certainly is a very effective therapy. But also all of this information that's coming from the patients is not only helpful in understanding how to program the detection and the stimulation for each patient to fine-tune it for that patient, but also we're learning so much about that individual's epilepsy and about epilepsy across the board. So I mentioned this data from the neurostimulator is sent by the physician and by the patient from their home over the internet to the secure database. And all of the data ever collected by the neurostimulator for every patient is there. One of the applications is discoveries that by looking at changes in the intracranial EEG, you can actually get a very good sense, 80% predictive power of whether a medication is going to be beneficial within 2 weeks. This is work from Yale and also work from some scientists at NeuroPace. This may shorten the trials that we go through. Another is that it tells you about the patient's behavior. So a study from Mayo Clinic in Rochester reported that in one patient, exacerbations and seizures correlated with a great increase in intake of caffeine. So they counseled a change in that behavior and that improved. And somebody else whose seizures got worse when their mother-in-law came to visit or when their data became more active. A very recent publication from Dr. Larry Hirsch at Yale reported on a group of patients who were treated with an RNS system in mesial temporal structures because they had been identified as people who would not benefit for resective surgery. But based on the data from the RNS system, it was found that in the real world, outside of the epilepsy monitoring unit, the seizures began exclusively in one temporal lobe, or in many cases, they did occur in both temporal lobes, but they were predominantly from one. And in these patients, they were treated with a surgical resection and continued treatment with an RNS system. You know, all of this really helps us understand how to use treatments together in a synergistic way. Now, there's some extremely exciting work coming out, really first reported by Vikram Rao at UC San Francisco, that used mathematical analyses to extract information from the intracranial EEG that showed periodicities. And we already knew that over 90% of people with the RNS system had very strong periodicities in when the interictal epileptiform discharges or electrographic seizures would occur. But he was able to find that in addition to these daytime cycles, there are multi-day cycles that are different patient to patient, but are the same within each patient. And he also showed that patients were more likely to report clinical seizures as that activity was picking up. So this raises the possibility of using this kind of data to forecast times when patients may be at greater risk.
That's a lot of exciting stuff to look forward to. Thank you again so much for joining us, Marty.
Thanks, Hallie.
For our listeners, you can find the full text of the article in this week's issue of the Neurology Journal. Again, the article is titled 9-Year Prospective Efficacy and Safety of Brain-Responsive Neurostimulation for Focal Epilepsy.
Thank you for listening this week. And as always, we hope you have a great week. Until next time.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.